U.S. equities closed at the highest point in market history yet again. The S&P 500 finished the week well over 2,000, and the Dow Jones Industrials over 17,100. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you here with another red-hot episode for you this weekend. We've got top interviews with your favorite investment experts, plus the financial market headlines affecting your portfolio. The first big guest discussion, G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, says global currencies are declining in their purchasing power, and he outlines the secrets behind what he calls an international banking cartel. He says the greenback could be replaced by a North American currency. Contingency plans are required for all of us to survive and prosper, including gold and silver assets, as well as basic necessities. Then the Wall Street whiz kid, Peter Granditch, returns to the show. He says a significant gold market bottom is forming and points to the favorable seasonal aspects. He says 1400 gold is the line in the sand that we've got to cross for the bull stampede to resume. And then Gold Seek Radio wraps up with Robert Ian's latest must-hear report, and we're offering 25% over to Robert Ian for all new subscribers to the Alpha Stocks newsletter. So if you've been on the sidelines and you'd like this daily updated report with a new stock pick every single day of the week, at least five a week, and we had some red-hot stocks this week, including Costco and many others, please sign up and you'll be helping the show and Robert Ian as well. And here's this week's health tip. You may have heard that I'm a big fan of Dr. Mark Hyman, who I think is really a national hero and certainly one of the finest physicians of the last 50 years. He's found a startling connection between health and glucose levels. He claims that 50% of Americans are diabetic, is the number one leading cause of illness. In fact, they're now calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes, suggests that folks try to cut out all sugar, any sugar on the label, toss it out, try it for 30 days, 14 days at least, and tell me how you're feeling. I'd like to hear from you all. It's certainly been a sea change moment here at the Waltzek household. We're embracing everything Dr. Mark Hyman suggests. He has 10 best-selling books and many videos for folks you can find on YouTube for free. Dr. Mark Hyman. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recapitulation. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the market this week on extreme dollar strength as negotiations between Ukraine and Russia took some of the premium out of the gold market story. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX Exchange, it was off less than $20, finishing up at $12.69 an ounce. Still higher for the year by about 3%. Silver was off only 29 cents, finishing at $19.22 with an earshot of $20. The XAU and gold silver's equities fell sharply, though, about 7%. Palladium dropped 16, closing at 890, recoiling from last week's 13-year high due to this temporary ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Russia is still the largest palladium producer, accounting for about nearly half of global output. Platinum was off about $14, finishing at $14.10 an ounce. West Texas Intermediate crude was off about $2.40 for the week, $93.43 a barrel. Well, the U.S. dollar advanced to a 13-month high against 10 major currencies this week. What I think is one of the largest components to the dollar rally is really euro weakness. And, of course, we're seeing the European Central Bank unexpectedly cut the benchmark lending rate yet again to negative 0.05%. And the ECB cut its benchmark lending rate down to virtually zero, 0.05%. One of its rates is still negative, and they introduced new stimulus measures. This, of course, turns investors to the U.S. dollar, which has put tremendous upward momentum in the greenback. The Labor Department reported this week that U.S. employers added the fewest jobs this year, 142,000 in payrolls last month. That was well below expectations of roughly 225,000 by economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal. Plus, more Americans are giving up the hunt for jobs. The news was viewed as gold positive by putting some pressure on the Federal Reserve to maintain lower rates. Currently, statistics show about a 46% chance the Fed will raise its benchmark interest rate target by June of next year. The unemployment rate declined to a seasonally adjusted 6.1%, but we still had a significant decline in the unemployment rate. This is the metric that most traders watch most closely. In geopolitical news, Ukraine and pro-Russian rebels agreed to a ceasefire to what one London-based media source terms the worst conflict between Moscow and the West since the end of the last Cold War. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko expressed optimism regarding the ceasefire with rebels. Nevertheless, the European Union still has plans on the table to impose sanctions on Russia. In Brussels today, representatives of EU governments are considering tightening the economic sanctions first set on Russia in July. The news temporarily removed some safe haven appeal from the metals, at least for momentum traders. Nevertheless, September is historically gold's best performing month of the year, returning on average 2.16% in 1 month alone, that since 1969. As consumer demand increases ahead of the Indian Diwali Festival on October 23rd this year, as well as their wedding season. We also have Christmas and Hanukkah and related holidays. In addition, there's the Ramadan holiday, which wrapped up between June and July, another key gold buying season. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, September, as I mentioned, a traditionally solid time of the year for the metals. We'll need to watch closely for signs of a market washout, hopefully within the next few weeks to months. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the fifth week running, with the Dow Jones Industrials closing at yet another all-time record high, as well as the S&P 500. Wall Street was clearly sanguine over the lower national unemployment rate figure. More jobs translates into robust corporate profits and by proxy share prices. For the week, the Dow added 40 points, around a quarter of a percent, finishing above the 17,000 point at 17,137. The S&P 500 was up 4 points, a little less than a quarter percent, wrapping up at 2007, a new all-time record weekly close, while the Nasdaq blasted higher by 3 points, finishing at 4583, nearly 1% for the week, and the best closing point since that dot-com implosion. Are we going to make it to 5,000 on the Nasdaq again? It's beginning to look like there's a solid opportunity for it to happen in the next year or two. Moving on, the U.S. equities bull run persisted this week on expectations of continued monetary stimulus from the Federal Reserve, coming in below expectations at about 225,000, as well as the European Central Bank rate cut on Thursday. Lower rates, of course, increases liquidity, adding fuel to the current expansion in our gross domestic product. According to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group, Fed funds futures contracts are showing odds of a rate increase decline sharply this week, adding further momentum to stocks, which prefer that liquidity. Shares in Starbucks Corp, ticker SBUX, added over 1% amid plans to launch smaller stores to cater to commuters. Shares added 80 cents or 1%, climbing to nearly $78. Plus, three of our Alpha Stock newsletter stocks blasted higher this week, including Costco, which had August sales at stores much higher than anticipated. They climbed over 7%, and the comparable store sales are the leading metric, which reveals the retailer's health because the number excludes recently opened or closed numbers. Revenues for Costco increased 10%. In addition, the IPO market remains robust, with the much-anticipated Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba set to go public at an estimated price range of around $60 to $66 a share, valuing the company at around $155 billion. Although I would point out that this is the middle of the range, which I don't think inspires a lot of confidence just yet. Typically, our best IPOs will price well above the range, and there's probably still time for that. Still, it is, I think, the IPO to watch. The price level is reminiscent of the Google IPO, and I think millions of investors will be watching for entry points for shares around the globe. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, we've probably all heard the expression, nothing succeeds like success, and this just holds true for the markets. The momentum remains strong. We appear to have entered a sweet spot where money managers are clamoring over one another to throw clients' capital into the ring. Will it be the greatest show on earth or a flea circus? Our favorite 7-indicator sentiment index is firmly planted in neutral category. So I think investors are complacent ambiguous to direction. So stay tuned. It promises to be another fascinating year for equities. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with G. Edward Griffin and Peter Grandich. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Well, my next guest is a gold market expert who compares the current market conditions to Bill Murray's Groundhog Day, where everything seems mundane, stuck in a rut, perpetual repeat mode. My guess is he's got some better news for us. Peter Grandich has published commentary on the mining and metals sector here, the senior commentator at MoneyTalks.net. Welcome, Peter Grandich.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Great to have you back. Well, maybe we should start off with a bit of levity. You know, Groundhog Day, the film that is with Bill Murray, does conjure up issues of the mundane, stuck in a rut, same thing every day, routine. And we've seen that for about a year, you know, silver and gold, even XAU for even longer. But for about a year now, we've consolidated, which is boring for folks. One ray of light, recall that 2008 to 2010 was one of the more boring periods I've ever seen in the silver market, but gold moved higher and higher, above 1,000, 1,200, 1,400, but silver stuck in a rut, couldn't get above 17 for nearly 2 years. Silver skyrocketed threefold up to $50 in just 9 months' time. You know, this is another boring period. It's another Groundhog's Day. Will we hear something more upbeat on the alarm radio in the next few months?
Well, my work has suggested that we should see a major low in the September time frame. There's a lot of cycle stuff that points to that. We also begin to enter soon a period of time when industrial demand for gold from jewelry fabricators increases dramatically at this time of season. But as I noted in the commentary you referred to, that we could look at three of the main factors that were influencing both bulls and bears for gold, and you could look at the cup half full and say, okay, gold was holding it more than its own through the height of one after another new bullish new highs in stocks and bonds. You could look at the bullish side and say that it was holding its own as geopolitical tensions broke concern. But at the same time, you could then look at those same factors and say, well, you know, it really should be rising in this geopolitical concerns, and it wasn't. And stocks and bonds really are reaching, you know, such a stratosphere that there should be some interest in gold, and isn't happening. So I kind of put it in a Groundhog Day saying that really, if you look at where we've been for 18 months, is an extremely rather tight but still interesting trading range, about 1180 to 1200 on the bottom of gold, and about 1350 to maybe 1400 on the height. And that's after, you know, a tremendous decline from the highs of 2011. So it's painful in the sense that for those who want to see it rally and rally strongly. But keep in mind that so long as it stays within that trading range, the longer that trading range exists, and then if it does turn up, the much bigger the move will be to the upside. And yes, for those that might be saying, well, the same could be true if it breaks below that, yes, it would be. And we'd all have to rethink our bullish scenario. But right now, when you take into account the fundamentals and this long, drawn-out base-building period after a substantial decline, you have to give the benefit of the doubt to the bullish side.
I agree with you. And, you know, take a look at the XAU. You know, it's interesting to see the relative strength. Folks will recall back in 2001, 2002, it really was the XAU that led the charge out of the 20-year bear market. Well, we also saw the XAU lead us into this quiet period from 2008, relative strength when compared to the underlying bullion. Tell us more, please.
Well, there's no doubt that, yes, the mining shares were outperforming the metals for this year of 2014, and normally that is a bullish sign, and in past markets that has been an indication that eventually the metal prices pick up. The manipulation that I ad nauseum have talked about that, but just looking at the general market, is it's very hard when your biggest competitor or your biggest enemy is making new highs, justifiably or not, when stocks and bonds are not only the flavor of the day, week, month, and year, but seemingly a whole generation, it's very difficult for gold and silver to make headway in that. There's just not a lot of general retail interest that would be supporting. But keep in mind, the higher those metals go, and one of the reasons why I still remain bullish, even though gold and silver have been pretty flat for the year, is as higher those things go, the higher they go, the harder the fall will eventually be. And when that switch comes, and I wouldn't speculate on what date it may be, although, like I said earlier, there's some very interesting cycle work that suggests a very good chance of a major bottom here in the month of September. But when that turn comes, the higher the financial assets have gone, the more the decline will seem even more harsh, and the more likelihood that would kick money out of those type of investments, and some of it will find a home in the metals. But let's not forget, and this is very hard for people who live, the few people it seemingly that still live and breathe the metal prices each day, is that the financial service industry and the vast majority of the journalists that follow it are very anti-gold, simply because it flies in the face of everything that they make their living off. So you can't expect bullish articles, but you can bet your bottom dollar, and I would suspect as we speak, after a 20-something dollar down day, there'll be a whole host of articles, if we Google gold, about how bearish this is, and they'll bring out all the guys that have been talking about $800 for 5 years. But when gold zooms up, it's very hard to find the bullish article. So it's very, very important that if you're going to be long and stay long gold and silver, not to expect to receive comfort from the general financial service industry and the journalists that follow it.
The fundamental case is so strong for the precious metals, everything from central banking, repatriation of gold issues to geopolitical unrest that you've alluded to, everywhere from Ukraine, Gaza, and Iraq, not to mention the Argentine currency issue that we're watching there unfold in real time, where folks who had the foresight to convert their pesos into the yellow metal have in some cases doubled their investment, and not to mention sidestepped devastating purchasing power decreases. I think you really hit the nail on the head when you pointed directly to equities. This love affair with stocks. I think you'd agree with so many of my guests on the show. This is a false rally. A record number of stock buybacks where CEOs and officers accumulate their own shares. Well, of course, that creates artificial demand. You're buying back your shares. You're reducing supply, so price must move higher. That's just one leg of it, that we have a Federal Reserve, which is en route to $5 trillion backed up on its balance sheet, all while talking about being so hawkish. And then we have the ECB with its back up against the wall and a lot of talk of further stimulus, and not to mention negative overnight lending rates for their member banks. Tell us more, please.
Well, I think we need to go back to the original premise of what QE1 was introduced for. We had just gone through a terrible financial crisis, one that I don't think is over. It's just been Band-Aid over. But we were sold on the fact that if the Fed would create this ample new money out of thin air, that it would boost the economy, it would rally financial assets, and that would make people feel richer and go out and buy cars and washing machines, and employment would pick up and so forth and so on. And that was, if we go back and if you read the news, that was the sale point that politicians gave us and monetary authorities gave us for the QE1. And then, of course, when QE1 didn't do the trick, 2 and 3, what came about? The problem has always been that most of that money has stayed in Wall Street, not Main Street. But because these trillions of dollars that you mentioned was put into the game by creating bonds and the Fed purchasing those bonds and the money of those bonds that were purchased stayed within the financial system, the very elite or the people that have that type of access to that type of money has used the stock and bond market to reinvest that money and didn't go out and buy cars and refrigerators, except that on the guys that, the financial service guys that sell that stuff, and they went out and bought big cars, big homes. But it never really got to Main Street. And I believe that the only thing, the linchpin that has staved, starved off the dogs that would be calling for Obama's head right now because of all the other terrible things that have happened during his administration, the reason it hasn't happened yet is because the stock market remains high. And so the perception is by the average American that, although I'm not seeing it, obviously somebody is, because the market's going up, and it's got to filter down to me someday. If and when the stock market corrects, or better yet, tanks and doesn't rally, and then all the other problems are there, you'll see the rug pulled out from under this perception, and suddenly this very same scenario that one day caused the market to go up but is now causing it to go down, all the underlying problems will now suddenly be acute, and everybody be screaming for them to be fixed. So I, again, the stock market and financial assets in general, stocks and bonds, and for reasons, as I just discussed, why they went up, has really not only kept a revolt, so to speak, of just the entire work of Obama, but it's also been something that has suppressed gold and silver because it's the arch enemy, and people are saying, what do I need to touch gold and silver? That's a great argument you make, Mr. Granich, but at this point in time, it's not going anywhere, and every day stocks and bonds are going up, so I got to get on board with that. And that's the mentality we're at, but we're always at those levels at towards the end of a move, and sometimes I say maybe it's better of us, instead of trying to pick the bottom, let the bottom happen, let it be clearly put in, and while we might have missed the first 10 or 20% of the move, we can certainly be more certain that when we do go in, it'll be successful. And I think when it comes to gold, we need to have that above $1,400. I think if and when, if we live long enough to see it, when we're back above $1,400, everything will be rip-roaring and all systems will be go. So if I was extremely conservative, I would wait for that. But if one is like you and I think, are more and are convinced that this is a trading range and you use weakness to accumulate, then that's what you have to do in these time frames.
So you don't buy then the thesis that we could be facing a long period of deflation that keeps commodities and, of course, the precious metals under pressure?
Well, I got to tell you something. It's funny you say that. Just before the Labor Day weekend, I spoke at a huge business group. It was made up of business people from around the United States in a variety of degrees. And the theme that came out of when we went to the Q&A and many people participated was that in just about every field that was represented there, they all spoke about how much prices have gone up. First of all, anybody's gone shopping for food. It's just across the board. You talk to any housewives, and they feel that their food bill has doubled over the last few years. But we had a bunch of people from the building industry, and they talked about all the costs of their supplies in building have gone up 20-30% in the last year. And then we talked to people that were in the car business and the airline business and costs of airline tickets. And yet the government reports that we're either flat or up just 0.1%. And it's a farce. But, you know, again, like I said, most of the financial journalists these days make their living on the success of Wall Street maintaining this type of mode, and so they don't get into the deep analogy reporting. But it's clear and evident when you speak to business people across a wide spectrum that costs are up dramatically. So that's the deflation argument is a paper tiger, because when you look at the reality of just about everything, everything is going up and going up dramatically. In fact, I like to say to people, and it was said at this group meeting, name something that's gone down in price.
I think what people are wondering here, though, is when does this translate into higher prices for the metals? I mean, I'm on board with you. You know, everything from health costs, groceries, you name it, keeps moving higher. Do we have to go through another year 2000-like internet bubble before people wake up?
Well, first of all, I would have suspected well over a year ago we would have been higher already, so I'm probably not the best person to answer, you know, when's it going to go up. I do know this, and that when you had a substantial move, and the last big move in gold and silver was down from the highs of 2011 to the bottoms that were made just between 12 and 18 months ago. When you have a move like that, and then you have this long sideways move, about 8 out of 10 times they're foundation moves, not resting stops before another down leg. Now, there's Elliott Wave guys out there, and people take different counts, and they see the same chart, and they come up with a different interpretation and all. But my belief is, because financial assets are the exact opposite of hard assets, and therefore stock and bond market don't go up to the moon and gold goes with it, the fact that gold has just even held during, you know, another 20, 30, 40% rise in stocks and bond prices and all, suggests to me strongly, only from 30 years of being around this, that gold's relative strength compared to that is suggesting this is a bottoming formation, not a sideways consolidation and there's another leg down. I mean, I don't sell anything related to gold. I'm no longer involved in the junior resource market. There's no exception for me to want to kind of favor one side, even maybe because in the back of my mind, I need that to happen. I've looked at this objectively. I'd stand up today, and if it looked any different, say so. It just appears that as tough as it is to take here, the longer this sideway action goes, and then the inevitable breakout should be to the upside, the stronger that move will be. And so with, like, unlike the government that's borrowed from our future to pay for now, we're borrowing from our current to get paid for in the future when it comes to gold and silver.
The case that we would be entering another 1980 to 2000 period is a hollow case at best. When we look at the Fed's balance sheet, when we look at the balance sheets of their colleagues around the world, the central bankers around the world, we see the difficulty at repatriating gold. As you say, the cost of goods and services skyrocketing. Eventually, the doldrums will pass. And these markets, they have a momentum factor that can't be underestimated today with such a huge pool of funds leveraged to the hilt. I mean, we're talking everything from hedge funds to institutions with very deep pockets. So when I think the hot money starts to chase these markets, gold and silver, all bets are off at that point, don't you think?
Well, as I said at this conference last week, that when I entered the brokerage business in 1984, about 86% of the trading in what was then the primary market was the New York Stock Exchange, was retail investors. It's estimated now that retail investors make up 10% or less of the trading. In fact, there's species now that are involved in a market that didn't exist. We have people that trade off a computer algorithm. They don't even know or care what the name of the stock is or what the business does. We have people that have set up communication highways so they can front run you and know and get ahead in front of your order. They don't care about any fundamental factor about the markets and all. In some sense, even though here in Jersey we've had news of casinos closing, I think that, you know, the financial markets have become the ultimate casino, certainly dramatically different or 180 degrees different than when I entered the business 30 years ago. And so when you have all of that, and then you have this accommodating mode where money is, in a sense, being handed to these folks, and they basically have watched the last financial crisis where people broke laws and almost very few, if none, paid any price. And I think they sit in their offices going, hey, you know, let's go for it. You know, and that is the sad commentary that there were no lessons really learned from the last crisis. This was a key point, and I'm just going to reiterate it one more time, and that is the real crisis in the last financial crisis was people who could ill afford to be lent money were and bought bad mortgages, and the people who actually lent it to them and sold it to them not only knew that, but then they took the other side and bet on their failure. And I've told people it was the same as if car manufacturers knowingly made those cars poor, and then they went ahead and bet on what life insurance and the driver, knowing they were going to crash and die. And if you think about that, and that's exactly what happened during the financial crisis, and the net result was There's been almost no one or group other than substantial fines, which were just maybe 5 or 10 cents on the dollar, what those groups actually made. I can only imagine that when the next financial crisis comes and everybody goes back and sees what's been done these last few years, it'll be a whole host of many of the same people, only the game changed a little. And that's what I think is the biggest potential crisis. As bad as we hear the geopolitical stuff out there and terrible terrorism and all this stuff, I really think that the markets have become so unfair and so unbalanced against most people, and that there's so much people doing a variety of things that are either in a gray area or over the line and way over the line, that it's only a matter of time when anything like that becomes so rigged and so scandalous that eventually when it breaks, it's like a dam, and then it's just going to be, you know, so much flowing at us. And it would not be surprising if someone can tell you to look back at history, it would come at a time when the people who are in charge, administration, that it's been so full of fraud and bad handling the thing, it should come on a watch like that. And so I don't know what day it is, and I've given up, you know, trying to think I'm going to guess the right day. I think I'm going to live long enough, please God, to see it. And when it does come, there'll be a dramatic change, and we'll go back to like it was in the late 70s, and hard assets will once again be sought out by the people that still have money, and all in gold and silver's day will shine in those days.
Are there any other issues on the docket that you'd like to share with the listeners today? Any topics regarding the precious metals that we haven't covered?
I just think that what's difficult to overcome at this time is really lack of interest. It's not so much that there's a terrible negative fundamentals and it's a sure thing to go down. But really what's happened is that we see a lack of interest. First of all, I think if your listeners got to sit in any financial institution or major financial service firm, whether it's on the insurance side, the banks that sell it, or the brokerage firms, you will not hear 0.1% of the sales force suggesting to people to be involved in anything related to the gold and silver market. And I think that's absolutely critical. And the reason it's critical is this. I remember studies going back into the 1980s, you know, and into the 90s that would show that if just 0.2% of the money that was back then in financial assets would move into the gold and silver market, what impacts they would have on those markets to the upside. And I believe that there has been somewhat of an increase in sophistication of people. The Internet has created a great part in that. And that when the cup goes from half full to half empty, this enormous amount of money, although by then it will have taken a hit of some sort, of some correction or substantial decline, just a small shift of that will find its way into the gold and silver market. And then what I used to call the crazy numbers, because even I wouldn't speak at them, to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 on gold, $100, $200 on silver, will have a legitimate chance of seeing their day. And so as hard as it is right now, just understand that the longer we continue in these trading ranges, and then inevitably, in my opinion, break out to the upside, the bigger that move will be. And if you're going to be bullish, then as much as you'd like to see it happen now, if we go another 6 months sideways and then break up, just know that the upside then will be a lot higher than it would have been otherwise.
When you start to think about the $quadrillion of interest rate sensitive debt that we've accumulated around the world using everything from mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, add your own debt instrument in there. They're coming up with new ones almost every week. Nothing has changed. We have not learned anything. That's not what happened, is it? We saw what we did in 2006 through 2008. We wrote off the bad debt. Instead of pouring money into the banks, we actually allowed them to shut their doors, many of them. We have written off the debt. We've gone through a deep recession, but we've come out of it wiser, leaner. We've heaped even more debt upon debt. We've added another $1 trillion to our Federal Reserve balance sheet. We've got interest rates at unbelievably low levels. So all that's really happened is we've rolled the can. We can't even kick the can down the road anymore. It's just a matter of time. A large share of your portfolio must be comprised of the precious metals. And if you don't have that safety net, if you don't have a 10 to 25% safety net and you're holding on to paper promises, Peter Granich, could you tell folks more about the interesting services you provide?
Well, first, I'm the senior commentator for MoneyTalks.net, and that's where one can find my general market and economic observations. And then I'm the managing member of Trinity Financial Sports and Entertainment Management Company here in New Jersey, where we offer both the professional athletes as well as individuals individual business, retirement, and estate planning services.
Peter Granich, thank you so much today.
Thank you for having me, as always.
The U.S. dollar continues to be plagued by fiscal irresponsibility and monetary profligacy. Our special guest today thinks that the greenback's days may be numbered. A new currency is inevitable. G. Edward Griffin, author of several best-selling hits, including, of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and he runs The Reality Zone with Joan Hunter. Welcome back, Mr. Griffin.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, I wonder if we could start off with the U.S. dollar. You know, the halls of history, I think you'd agree, are lined with the carcasses of defunct currencies. The once mighty pound eventually gave way, the sterling, to the dollar. You seem to think the dollar may have to pass the torch as well, that its zenith could be approaching. A new currency might replace it.
Yes, the phrase passing the torch triggered a couple of thoughts. In the past, that was pretty much the case, that there was always one currency in the world or more that had some real value to it in the form of the productivity of the society, or preferably in the form of some kind of backing in terms of gold or silver, so that the money itself had some intrinsic value that was recognized universally for something other than money, which is what gives money its real backing. Money can survive and be accepted quite well for long periods of time, provided that the nation issuing it is a strong military force and can dominate the world. And, you know, you better like us, or we'll send our troops over there and we'll call you terrorists or something. You know, that works for a long time, but then it fades, and maybe people get tired of playing that game, and those countries tend to overspend themselves, they become weak, and then they're replaced by another strong nation. So the torch was passed in the past, but today we're going through something a little bit different, and that is that all currencies in the world now are, the flame is going out, you might say, in the torch. Who are you going to pass it to? You might say, well, China, maybe, or maybe the Leninist bloc, you know. Who knows? Maybe there's some group in the Middle East that will back its currency by gold. They talk about that, but it's not really happened on any scale. So what's happening today, Chris, is that the bankers of the world, who really now create the money, it's not the nations of the world anymore. It's the bankers that create the money. And anybody that has read my book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, they would know how that works. But we can come back to that perhaps later. The banks create the money in the name of the nation, and the money is just it's credit money and backed by debt. So all of these bankers now have played that game, and they've used it quite effectively to transfer wealth to themselves and their institutions. And now that process has gone about as far as it can go, because there isn't much more left, you know, to transfer. It's moving rapidly off in one direction. And so now what? Now what's the end game of that? And so all of these bankers and these various systems have been working together for quite some time to create a new currency, and it will not be a national currency this time. It will be an international currency. First, a regional currency like the euro. You know, that was the first step to get the currencies of Europe into a regional common currency produced by the European market, the European Union. And they're working on it, of course, in North America. They're calling it the AMERO for United States, Canada, and Mexico. And that's not happened yet, but they're pushing it as hard as they can. And the grand design on all this is that after these regional currencies are established in Europe, North America, Asia, Africa, and and the Pacific Rim and so forth, and they have all of them in place working on them. Then the next step, after maybe 20 or 25 years, when that currency blows up and it suffers from the same fate of all fiat currencies, then they're going to transist into a international currency. Who knows what it'll be called, but perhaps it'll be called the Bangkor. And then that's the end of the road, because there'll be no torch to pass. There'll be nobody to accept the new torch. The whole world will be saddled with one currency. It'll be essentially the same in character as all of the little fiat currencies that have been used by the various nations of the world. But it's the end of the process, because now the world is globalized, as they say. It's all one governance. It's all one currency, all one military force. It's all one world government, and that's the end of the line.
Well, that's a very succinct and tactful overview of what's going on. But I'd like more about how we got to this point. I mean, how we received the torch. And you alluded to that. You said you might be interested in maybe giving folks a primer here on just what the mechanisms are over the, let's say, the last century that led us to this point. Much of what's been fed to us in the mainstream may not be as accurate as we once thought. People are looking for answers. They want to know this topic of the evils of capitalism. I mean, we seem to run into this everywhere, but is it that maybe what we think of as modern capitalism has been mangled to such a point that, you know, that our forefathers wouldn't even recognize what we call capitalism today?
Yeah, those are two real meaty topics. I'm tempted to deal with that second one and forget the first one, but I guess we need to start first places first. Don't let me forget to get back to this so-called capitalism. But the history of how we got to where we are is a fascinating one. You said it's been going on for a century. The process is several centuries old. It started here in the United States a century ago. But the process has a code name to it that is used in the financial industry. They call it the central bank. That's the instrument or the institution that is, that brings this to us, you know, coming to your country soon by a national or rather a central bank. And they call that thing a central bank. Our Federal Reserve is a central bank, and it's modeled after the Bank of England, which is the granddaddy, the original central bank. And all that means, central has some meaning, because it means it's centralized and the power and the authority is all brought together in one place. It is a bank in a sense that people go to it and they use it as the medium for their transactions. They put their money into the bank, they borrow money from the bank and so forth, and all of that. So In the modern sense, it is a bank. In the traditional sense, it's not, because what you put in there has no value. It's just it's a what you call an accounting program more than anything else. It's nothing of value. It's just numbers. But anyway, it's true. It's old. It's a couple of centuries old. And what a central bank really is, if you strip out the code name and just describe it in plain English, is that it's a cartel. It's a cartel of banks. It's in most countries, it's more than just one bank. It's several commercial banks that have come together and formed a cartel to protect their own interests. And then because they are so fabulously wealthy and they control the money system, they have unseen influence over the politicians in those countries. They literally buy and sell them like so many pounds of raw hamburger. And that part is not too visible to the average citizen. But when you think about it, he who has the money makes the rules. Well, the banks not only have the money, they make the money. And so they buy the politicians, and the politicians pass the laws that make everything that the banks, everything that they do, they make it legal. The same things that would be terribly illegal if you or I were doing it. We can't just go make money out of nothing and then put it into circulation and loan it out at interest. That's mainly what the central bank does. And they pay off the politicians and say, hey, this is all in the best interest of the nation. This is what we call credit. This is the modern banking system, and without it, we'll all be living in caves and eating meat. Everybody goes along with it. That's a central bank. It's a cartel a group of private banks that literally control the money system, and because of that, they have great influence, if not total control, over their respective governments. So that's how we got there. In 1913, our central bank was passed into law. It was called the Federal Reserve System, but it was really modeled after the Bank of England. And when you look at the Federal Reserve, it is a cartel. It is not a government agency, although they went out of their way when they formed it in 1913. They went out of their way to make it look like a government agency. You know, they called it Federal Reserve, makes it federal. It's about as federal as FedEx. And they have no reserves to speak of. It's all kind of a smoke and mirrors game. So we got there because the banks decided that they wanted to get ahead of the parade. And what I mean by that is that back in 1910, when they started to work on this, from 1910 to 1913, when this plan was put into operation, there was a hue and cry among the American people who wanted banking reform. They knew that there was too much power in Wall Street. They knew that these banks had too much control over credit and the economic flow and ebb of money in the society, and they wanted Congress to control those big bad banks, you know. And so the bankers decided, hey, why do we sit around and wait for Congress to do something and pass laws to regulate our industry? Let us be the ones that drafts that law to control our industry. And so they met in secret on Jekyll Island back in 1910. They prepared the basic outline of their cartel agreement of how they wanted their system to be operated by them, not by anybody else, not by the government. And then they took that cartel agreement to Washington, and they wrote across the top of that agreement the words Federal Reserve Act. Convinced them that they should pass their cartel agreement into law, which they did. And so now, by December, the end of December in 1913, the cartel agreement of the banking cartel became law. And ever since, you and I have had to abide by those terms, or we go to prison. And since it was passed into law, And there are prison penalties for disobeying that agreement, everybody thinks it's a government agency, but only government can send you to prison, right? Well, no, wrong. The banks do. And so that, in a nutshell, is how we got there. It was trickery from the top to bottom. It was fraud and deceit, and it still is. It's even worse now than it ever was. And if you ever wonder what's really going on, just look at these bailouts and all these huge economic programs that they're passing in Congress. So they want $1 billion here and $1 trillion there to bail out the banks or bail out the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and bail out all of the savings and loan institutions and bail out General Motors, who have these huge loans to the banks, and they bail out Mexico, and they bail out other countries who have these huge loans to the banks and to keep those interest payments coming. And you look at all of this and you scratch your head, and if you forget the words that the politicians are using, like, we're doing this for you folks, we're doing this to save the system, we're doing this to save America, we're doing this, you know, for all these good reasons, so that children will have milk and all that sort of thing. But when you look at the result, where does that money go? Well, it goes to the banks. Every bit of it goes to the banks. And then you think, aha, I get it now. This is a banking cartel we're dealing with. And it's as simple as that.
But there's so many interesting facets to the story. For instance, originally, this was done covertly, I'm sure you agree, but I mean, my goodness, they're doing it right in front of our faces today. I mean, Goldman Sachs, they call it government Sachs at the Treasury Department now, because there's so many former key executives in the organization in Washington, D.C. There were other freedom fighters. You know, most people point to Thomas Jefferson and some of the others who warned of central banks, and they'd just seen what happened in the French Revolution and the heads rolling in the streets of Paris. Andrew Jackson comes to mind, the great central bank warrior, based his presidency on defeating the central banks. And it only took them a few more decades before they finally had the noose around our necks.
Yeah, the history is very, very strong with examples of this ongoing conflict. As you've just said, this is quite historical. It does go back a couple of centuries, And it's reaching the end game, though, and that's how we started this discussion. This only can go through so many cycles before it changes character. And it's reaching at the end of the game now so that the character will change. It's not going to be just another economic cycle from which everybody recovers. You know, it's not just another depression and boom-bust cycle, all of that sort of thing. People take comfort in thinking, well, it's bad now, but it's been bad before, you know, and we always recover, don't we? This is a strong nation. Americans won't stand for any of this very much longer, you know, because these are good people and all that. And it's a comforting thought. But when you really look at the details of this historic fabric, you see that we're coming to the end of the rug. We're at the edge of the rug now, and the fabric is changing. And when we get off of the rug, we're into a whole new system. And that's what's really scary to me. As long as you can just look at it as a historical play on the stage, you know, it's fascinating, it's interesting, and you can say, well, I learned a lesson from that, and maybe I can protect myself and my family, and maybe, you know, we can do better. Maybe we can even take advantage of this, because it's possible along the way for people who are very smart and who understand this cycle to take advantage of it and make money while everyone else is losing money. But at the end of that process, you're off the rug, you're off the fabric, and you're onto the hard cement now. And I think that's we're coming to that point. And let me explain what that means in my mind, at least. I think that the system is so strained that it will not be able to operate much longer as it has in the past. It is rapidly moving toward a command economy, such as we have seen very graphically in the Soviet Union. And even though they drop that for a while, they're returning to it also. All nations of the world now are returning to the Soviet style of administering economic and social policies and political policies. So we're coming now to a new stage in world history for where the whole world is going definitely tyrannical. It's going into despotism, it's totalitarianism, and when you can no longer produce anything on the basis of economics, you know, that people want to go to work and they want to produce things because they have a profit motive, and they can provide for themselves by working hard and being innovative. When all that comes to an end, the only way you can make people work is to force them at the point of a bayonet. And, you know, you can herd them into trucks and put them into FEMA camps or work camps, or we used to call those concentration camps, but in Germany they called them work camps. You know, those you get an impression that all those people in the concentration camps in Germany were just there to be slaughtered and gassed, and that's not true. They were there to work. Those were where huge factories were located, and those poor people were, most of them, were put into slave labor, and that's what goes on in China, too. So anyway, the world, I'm trying to get to the point, is the world is moving in that direction now, because only when the economy finally collapses and nothing works anymore, the only thing that's left is the raw power of physical force. And that's what scares me to death, because this is a new chapter in world history. And this time around, it'll be global. And so there would be no place to go and no one to whom to pass the torch.
Think about Orwell's 1984, the playbook for the powers that be today. They learned the lessons. You know, we have to admit that our overseers, if you will, learn from their own mistakes. And I think what they learned from those camps that you've referred to, and it wasn't just, by the way, World War II, and we can go back to all of European history and see the pogroms and so many horrible times where minorities and other outcasts were put into groups and forced into labor or worse, serfdom, if you will, were hoodwinked into thinking, well, if I just pay my taxes, maybe I can beat this inflation. Oh, wait a minute, now the cost of goods have gone up so much higher, I can barely make ends meet. And then suddenly one little illness, one little accident on the way, the commute to work, and the whole house of cards implodes. There's no safety net. What contingencies can the everyday listener, the everyday investor, steps we can make to prepare now to help shield our families and friends against what we see coming?
That's a very important issue, and I'd like to address it, and I will. But before doing so, I'd like to point to a very important overview of this, which is that we'll be talking about short-term versus long-term preparation. What can you do on the short-term? What can you do for the long-term? The short term is pretty easy. It's right out of the textbooks. You know, you try and get out of debt, unless you're making money through debt, of course, and you're very confident that you can continue to sustain the debt and to pay the overhead. But to try and get out of debt, you certainly don't go into debt for consumption. You don't go into debt to take a trip around the world. Live within your means. You try and get off the track of the train wreck. And by that, I mean, we know that inflation is the great destroyer of fiat money around the world. And the United States is no exemption, has no exemption. So we're on the track, and we know that our money is going down, down, down in value every day, and yet we're saving money, right? And every day that our little nest egg gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's like being on this track, and you see this train coming down the track. I better get off this track, because if I keep all my savings and what little wealth I have in the form of money, like in a bank account or in an insurance policy, anything that's denominated in dollars, I'm going to be wiped out by that train. So the first thing is, hey, get off the track. Whatever savings you have, put as much of it as you can into something other than inflatable money. So that's the number one piece of advice I would give. And whatever that is, it sort of depends on your preferences. Gold and silver have always been a very good choice, but there are other choices too. You know, hard inventories are always good. Somebody said cynically the other day that they think that the best currency of the coming era will be bullets. And I had to stop and think, oh, wow, that's a very cynical, pessimistic view. But I had to say, you know, I'm afraid you're right. But you get the point that, paper money will go the way of all other fiat money has always gone in history. So if you're depending on that for your future, you're making a big mistake. Now, the long view, however, though, is we must save the system, or we must change the system. We must get this collectivist mentality out of the minds of the people. People who believe that the group is more important than the individual, that the government is the representative of society, and the government is this great solver of all problems, and the government will take care of us. And if we can't provide for our health care, then the government should do that. If we can't provide for our housing, then the government should provide that. If we can't pay for education, then the government should do that. If we don't have enough food, well, the government should give us food stamps, and on and on and on. And this process, it has been going on, and you end up at that stage, and the first thing you know, we're totally dependent on government for everything. And if we're totally dependent on government, we can never be free, because the hand that feeds you is the hand that controls you.
G. Edward Griffin, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and good luck to you, and good wishes to your listeners.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. This week on Netflix, my wife and I watched a fascinating PBS documentary called The Ghost Army, which discussed one of the most unusual strategies deployed by the Allies in World War II, the creation of an entire phantom army. The strategy remained classified until the late 1990s and detailed how the Army created a unit of over 1,100 men that were artists, designers, and sound engineers who utilized Hollywood and Broadway theatrical techniques to misinform and deceive during World War II. The methods involved look quite cheesy by today's special effects standards, but were state-of-the-art for that moment in time. They included painting camouflage on vehicles, using multi-layer, pre-recorded audio to fool opposing forces that massive military units were moving into one location when in fact they were somewhere else. Decoy unit locations, inflatable tanks, artillery, and scripted radio traffic helped perfect the various illusions which were utilized over and over again. Emerging from this unique military unit were notable architects and designers like Bill Blass. Retired General Wesley Clark was featured throughout this documentary. He spoke about deception and how it creates the element of surprise. In wartime, that's critical. It's expected. When we look at a documentary like this that took place so long ago, the people are old, if not deceased. The techniques are antiquated, and it's difficult to relate what we now know happened then to what is potentially happening now. It is an absolute fact that the strategy of deception is an acceptable policy in the military and wartime. But today, there are many different kinds of wars. The war on terror. The war on drugs. There are currency wars. Just Google the war on and scroll through about 10 pages and you'll get the idea. Since you now know that deception is an acceptable strategy and policy in wartime, the question you must ask yourself today is deception being openly practiced and not acknowledged in any of these modern wars that I hear so much about each and every day? Now, you might say that these various wars, the war on this and the war on that, aren't real wars. Oh, aren't they? Are you sure about that? Are you going to wait 50 or 60 years for a documentary to come out to tell you if you were right or not? Question what you hear. Analyze reality. Find out if you're being deceived. The war on this and the war on that are each part of a larger war that is in constant flux and contains the ultimate prize. It's a battle where ground is gained and lost each day, where sometimes major changes take place that set the course of history for decades. That war is the battle for your mind. And that's a battle where you personally can never retreat. And where you can take no prisoners. Chris, I'll be hosting the first ever Liberty Mastermind webinar on September 24th. Registration is free. Details are on my website. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.